Oh, I actually made it work. Good. I don't know what happened. I went to put Skype on, and I haven't been on the computer in a while, and there was no Skype. So I did it again, and now I'm useless. I'm completely useless with this stuff. Jeez.
No, Skype does that, and once it was bought by Microsoft, it just kind of liked updating itself.
Oh, I see. Okay, it has been a while. You're probably the last person I spoke to on Skype, so it's what, 3 years or something?
How are you? How are you getting on in lockdown, quarantine?
Good. Good. It's are we on now? This is it?
This
You're
is
really
it.
uncut?
Yeah,
Oh my God,
right
that's really
from the
funny.
time the phone rang.
Oh wow. God, that's just as well I asked now then. Well, yeah, I'm doing well. I'm here, I'm with my girls in Beacon. It's about an hour or so north of the city. And it's going pretty well. I mean, considering being stuck with two teenagers. We haven't killed each other yet, although it came close this morning. One of them, I'm painting my front porch, and one of them walked in on top of the wet paint and then tramped around the side of the house down the driveway, leaving footprints. And then the other one made a smoothie and didn't put the lid on the smoothie thing, and that went all over the kitchen. So that was all a bit of a chaotic morning. But yeah, a lot of cleaning up.
Yeah, it sounds like a movie. It sounds like, a teenage
Yeah.
movie kind of thing.
Yeah.
You see this little bubbly thing hanging off your earphones? That's actually the mic. So could you brush your hair back on that side? Because I can hear
I
it.
will.
Yeah, brilliant.
Okay. Should I
Brilliant.
turn it up a bit, or that
No,
only turns my
it just turns your
okay,
volume up.
there we
Yeah. No, you can hear it rubbing.
Nice.
Right. Are you in full lockdown? Because it seems to be different from state to state.
Yeah, it's I don't know what officially the rules are because obviously, I mean, the kids are off school, and I think that looks like it's gonna continue for the foreseeable future. And I have, let me think. I mean, I'm always home. I'm kind of always somewhat disconnected from everything. So the main difference is that they're around. And I know restaurants are closed for the most part, other than takeout. Everyone has to wear a mask when they're out and about. And yeah, that's I go to the grocery store every week, and that's exciting. And that's my big trip out. For the first couple of weeks, we couldn't go anywhere at all because my girls had a bit of a contact with somebody that may have had it, so we had to have no contact at all. Somebody bring us food, so
Okay.
we couldn't go out the house at all for that time. And even and now my girls haven't seen their friends since this all started a couple of months
Yeah,
ago,
right.
which is hard for them, I think. But yeah, they're coping. They're doing a lot of baking. Yeah, there's
Okay.
lots of we're all going to be enormous by the time this is done.
Yeah. It seems to be going one way or the other. People are either getting really fit or they're putting on weight. There's
Yeah,
no middle
exactly. Yeah,
ground
we're
with
not.
this.
I know we're not doing the fit thing. We're opting for the other option.
Right.
Yeah, because I don't want to. I can access the mountain from. They've officially closed the parking lot access to the mountain, like my mountain, I think of it as.
Yeah.
And there are other ways up there, but I am convinced. The minute I do that, someone's going to take a picture of me and social media shame me on the Facebook pages. So I've been most of the time staying home.
Yeah.
We're allowed out for walks, so I can kind of go up that way and try and get a run in here and there. But yeah.
Yeah,
And what about you?
we're fine. We were limited to 2 kilometers, no further than 2 kilometers, unless you go to the shops or something like that.
Oh, wow.
And then they expanded it to 5 kilometers. But I'm kind of like you. I've got a mountain behind, and that's within 2 kilometers, so it was fine. I can go up there. But
Oh, okay.
yeah, we're sort of getting ready to start opening up again. We've got a sort of five phase plan of reopening,
Right.
reintroducing, and we're sort of it really kicks off on Monday with the certain things will be able to go back to work, and not everyone, but it's the
Right.
beginning of it. Yeah.
Right. Where are you exactly over there?
County Kerry, down in the toe of Ireland.
Okay. Because I was in Ireland with my girls in August and
Really?
kind of, yeah, came over just for 10 days and you know, realized when I was looking, because I haven't been there since I was a teenager.
Yeah.
But then my dad's family were all from Donegal. So okay. I thought, I'll for once go over, you know, across the ocean and not go to Scotland. And so, because the girls were desperate to go to Ireland. So, you know, I enjoyed it way more than I even thought I would, actually. we my girls have now put a stop to the sleeping in the car is not cutting it anymore, or, you know, tents or any of those things. So now they're demanding fancy things like hostels and whatnot. So we stayed in hostels, which were actually very nice over there, and went up to Donegal, met my sister, came over from Scotland, and it was stunning. Really, yeah. I mean, there's people ask me about, you know, should I go to Ireland or Scotland? And I've always said, oh, go to Scotland. It's more remote. It's more, there's less tourists. It's, you know, I'm just talking up Scotland. But I don't know. Ireland is, the girls are now, you know, they're torn. I think they now want to go back there. So.
Yeah, yeah. What part of Donegal?
It's the place where... Okay, I'm so terrible with the names. This is bloody awful. Mount, there's a big an E.
Errigal.
It's a big, yes, that's it. That's okay. It. Yeah, so yeah. Not too far from there. And then I did the old family farm is somewhere. It's a place called Termin or something. It's not that far from there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we went to the local pub in Errigal, and, you know, my sister and I, we don't see each other very often, my older sister. So she has a different kind of memory of how, of she's a different, you know, I've kind of evolved a little more than I think she realizes, because, you know, growing up in Scotland and growing up in a pub, there's obviously a lot of alcohol consumption. So when I spoke to her, you know, when I got off the plane and I was heading up, she was going to get there before me. She was like, I'm just going to stop and get some wine on the way. And I just, you know, do you drink red or white? And I said, I drink red wine. And she's like, you drink beer too? I was like, yeah, well, beer. So we get there and she had, I don't know how many bottles of wine, 24 beers. And then she had also brought these cans, like 10 cans of gin and tonic.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, because I know you like to hike. And I was like, well, I do, but...
yeah, preferably in a straight line, yeah.
Normally I do that sober. So, yeah, so it was a little bit... it was fun.
Yeah,
that way.
Those combination things that come in a can, that's practically rocket fuel. Like, they have to... You make it like rocket fuel to be able to put it in a can like that?
Yeah, it was, I only had one of those and I had all these left because, you know, she doesn't drink that much. And so I don't know, I just assumed I was going to consume all of this by myself. and I made a dent, but then, you know, we still had some of it rolling around in the car when we went back to drop off the car. And I had been just really reluctant. It just felt like sacrilegious to throw alcohol away unopened. So I know, and I asked the lady at the car hire, at the car rental place when I dropped it off. I was like, handed her a bag of cans and bottles. And I was like, you know, I know it's probably inappropriate to say this, but, you know, if you want to, she was like, I'll take that. Thanks very much. I thought maybe it would be against, but she was very happy. So,
yeah, yeah. You're looking to get your hand back there.
Yeah, no, it was great. But it was lovely. Everyone was so, sounds such a cliche thing to say, but everyone was very lovely and friendly and just delightful wherever we went. It was really great, I have to say.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the scenery up in Donegal is very similar to Kerry. It's very remote, very wild. It's very similar. Yeah, we went up there, wasn't this year, last year. Yeah, and yeah, it's lovely up there.
I can't wait to get back, yeah.
Brilliant. Have you been binge watching anything during the lockdown? Are you a binge watcher?
I am a binge watcher. I'm a binge listener to things, mainly podcasts. Rewatching House.
Oh yeah.
or some of it. I'd watched some of it, but then I'm remembering now why I stopped watching it after the second season the first time around, because it didn't do much for my hypochondria. You know, so
oh, yeah.
I was just learning all of these new things that I might have.
Yeah.
So now I might have to stop before the end again.
Yeah, you start getting obsessed about the mold in your kitchen, if you have any mold. Or whether you do have any mold. Everyone seems to have mold in their kitchen in that show.
Yeah, I know. Everything is about that. Or, there's the certain vasculitis. I don't know what that is, but, you know, I have a rule that I'm not allowed to Google any symptoms for anything because that, you know, just to keep me somewhat sane. Yeah. So,
to rinse that out of your mind, you can look it up on YouTube, Jeeves and Worcester with Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. And when you see Hugh Laurie being Worcester, it just completely
gets
rid of it. Do you know? Have you seen it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I remember a little bit of Fry and Laurie.
Yeah,
I remember that. I never really watched Jeeves and Worcester, but I should.
Oh, Jeeves and Worcester is brilliant.
All right, that's a good thing. That's the thing for the list because I'm kind of running out. I love all of those the British detective, middle-aged lady detective shows.
Oh yeah,
you know, Happy Valley and Broadchurch and stuff like that. They're my favorite. Right. I can't get enough of those. So
very good. And you're going to be one of the jurors for the Bennett Prize, for the next Bennett Prize.
Oh, yes, I know. Very exciting.
Yeah,
I know. Great. This is, remember discussing it with them several years ago when it was an idea that was forming and, such a great, I mean, the nicest people in the world, first of all.
Yeah.
Oh, you've spoken to them. Yes. Yeah, so you know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just doing such a great thing there. So, yeah, very, very pleased to be a part of that.
Do you know who the other jurors will be yet?
I believe Alyssa Monks. And then there's also... I know his name is Patrick. Oh, I'll find his name in a second. This is terrible. I do think there's something going on with my, I'm just losing it entirely with the memory.
Alyssa Monk's going to be, I'm going to be talking to Alyssa tomorrow night.
Oh, great. I'm looking forward to seeing what's out there. I'm discovering some new artists and whatnot.
Yeah, they had a huge entry last time. I think it was 700 and something or other. Yeah,
it'll be even
more this time. Yeah.
Oh yeah, with all of the PR about it. Yeah.
Yeah, so. And the fantastic videos that were made by me.
Yeah. Of course.
Okay, so the last time you were on the podcast, that's late 2016. What's the major things that have changed?
Oh.
Has anything changed?
I guess yes. Life has changed a bit. I'm a little less solitary than I was, I suppose.
Right.
I'm trying to think what else. My girls are, I guess I always thought when they were young that as they got older, it would be less and less, I'd have more and more time in the studio. It's not really working out that way because the older one is, going to be heading off to college, hopefully in person in the fall, but we don't know yet. But
okay.
So that whole helping her with that whole process of the application thing and driving her around to dozens of colleges to visit them and whatnot, it was just took up a lot of time. And it was fun. It was great. But it's, I'm at the same time, I'm dreading that finally happening and her leaving. But, it's funny how... I've been thinking a lot recently about that. Just I'll finally have time that I've not really ever had. And I have been, it's been an interesting few years actually, in terms of thinking about the work, I've been kind of, I think a lot back then I was still in that mode of, it's a lot of very self-portrait stuff about what was going on in my own, like processing what was going on in my own life, visually. And, I'm not really in the same place, I suppose. I'm actually dating someone. So that's something that I thought would never happen again.
Nice.
So that is, it's funny how, someone I've known for years and, it's just kind of crept up on me and it's great. But, it's funny when things have evolved also, in the immediate aftermath of a big thing like a split, things can be very fraught. And, I think my fears around that time were about what, the long-term impacts on my girls and, I'm a bit of a, and I can be prone to anxiety, I suppose, and sort of catastrophizing.
Right.
And as it's turned out, it's all been quite good. Girls are great. They couldn't be better. And they now have a stepmom that they love and a new baby sister that they love. And they have, my boyfriend that they get, I'm like, oh, actually they're doing great. They've got loads of adults, looking out for them now. And, and so that means I'm not in that same spot of like panic, I suppose, in a way about the long-term thing. And so that gave way to then, okay, now then a lot of anxiety about what that meant for the work and, sort of a bit of a crisis of you know, what do I do now? Is that all I was really, you know, kind of the almost, I could always rely on that steady stream of sort of isolation, the self-imposed isolation that I wonder if I didn't maybe keep around longer than I should have kind of for that reason, I think sometimes unconsciously maybe did, you know, sitting in this kind of isolated spot and painting about being isolated. And so, you know, it's only in the last, I would say last 3 months, 6 months, probably, I've sort of turned a corner on that front and realized that I have plenty to say about, you know, plenty of things. And I'm working on quite a lot of new stuff now that I probably won't put out there until most of it's done. So it'll be a while. But it's a very different direction, not in terms of the way I'm painting, but the content is quite different. Because, you know, it's more outwardly focused than inwardly, I suppose. But it still does, you know, it's all connected. There's always, you know, it's just, I had to close a bit of a door on it. You know, I was getting in a bad, I kept producing work over that time that I just didn't like, because I realized that what I was doing was producing what was expected of me, but my heart wasn't in it. You know, I'd be like, this is what people are looking for. And I'm not actually feeling that right now, but hey, I had this idea, you know, 4 years ago, and why not I just do that? But they never, I've realized the hard way that just doesn't work. Yeah, and I'll show those paintings to people and they're like, oh, they're great. This is, you know, you should put them. And they're just, I don't know, there's probably 12 of them all just 80% done and stacked up against the wall. And they'll probably never see the light of day unless I can find a way to turn them into something else.
Yeah.
Because I just kept getting to that point and being like, oh, this doesn't, the other ones were completely, you know, like I couldn't not paint them. They just had to come out. There was, and these ones just felt too, they just didn't feel, they felt a little forced. And so the new stuff I'm working on is more about, it's they're all going to be men for one thing, which is new for me, but that's, it's just a more interesting, it's what I'm interested in now. I'm interested in men now. No, I mean, I'm interested in other, you know, big questions, I suppose. And so that's, it's broadened a little bit,
right.
But it still feels now finally I'm working on stuff that it does feel engaged. It's engaging me in the same, not on the same topics, but it feels the same. I feel the same compulsion to get out there and work.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a relief.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about painting. Unless you paint super fast, there's a delay between.
Yes.
What comes up?
I'm so jealous of those people where I see that they, you know, they paint in such a way that it's dynamic and done really obviously fairly quickly. And I just, if I could change one thing, I've tried a million different ways to speed up and loosen up and, you know, and I'll always be trying to do that, but I end up just getting locked into that same, you know, kind of, almost OCD thing kicks in. And so, yeah, I think that you're totally right, because you can feel one way at the start of it, and then by the end of it, you're just sick of it, and it doesn't even know what you're doing it for anymore.
Yeah. So what are the big questions that you're looking at now?
Well, I suppose, I don't know. I was spending a lot of time thinking about men and this kind of new changing reality for mainly white men over the last few years. I find it very interesting. I think it's a big shift in how they are regarded and how they have to navigate the world, and this new awareness that, you know, that women have always, you know, women's reality is now being made plain, I think, in a way. And I think there are ways that is a little too much. And then there are ways that I'm so glad that we're finally at this point. So just these big kind of observations about being a guy now, where, you know, really being a man now is just a very rapid shift and a necessary one, I think. But I'm interested in what that does when you sweep up an entire category of person.
Yeah.
And look at them through the, you know, it's gone from being given all the benefit of the doubt all the time to this very cynical lens that we're looking through it now. And I think it's just interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about it without even, you know, realizing that I was.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just, you know, maybe 6 months ago, I had the first one kind of popped in my head the way they used to when they were self-portraits, or, you know, they would pop in my head and I'd be like, oh, kind of almost fully formed. That's a, and then that started happening, but it was all guys.
Yeah.
And it was right. All certain guys in a certain situation, and or each of them not, they're not, you know, they're all different, but I realized, oh, that's what I'm, see, I had to completely close the door on the other stuff and just give myself permission to not paint for, I thought maybe forever, but it ended up only being a couple of weeks.
Right.
And so after years of being questioning, oh, what should I be doing? Suddenly then the floodgates open again and I'm back at it. So so that's kind of the very broad the first grouping. Actually they're both I'm thinking of them in a big group of, you know, each one is maybe 7 or 8.
Yeah.
And the first one is looking at it through a more cynical lens and the second grouping is a more compassionate lens.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it's just a, and it's just, it's stuff I'm into. I don't know. The thing is, I had to also be willing to let go of what was more of a sure thing sales wise and, you know, what was expected. And that felt like, I think I had to be prepared for that all to let go of all of that before this next phase started,
you know,
the ideas started generating again. So I'm glad to know that I still have something that's going to compel me to paint.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't at all what I expected would happen. So,
yeah.
So that's a good thing.
So did you talk to men about that, or is it just your sense of it?
I am always having these types of conversations, I suppose. I do. I discuss it with men, with women. I'm really interested in the subject because, I mean, it's a big topic. And, you know, every time a news story comes out, then there's I read all the different perspectives on it. And, you know, I love getting into a good old debate with people just at the pub with it. Well, in the old days. And so I suppose it's always been interesting to me.
Yeah.
Just how, you know, all the different perspectives on this. And, you know, as someone, you know, every female has their own experience over the years of, you know, various, you know, of it's so resonant with all women on one level that I don't think men can ever really get. And I think it's maybe unfair to expect them to get it completely. You know, there's certain experiences that other women have that I can't, you know, like, I think maybe it's a little, we can expect them to behave better for sure. But I think it's interesting trying to get through sometimes to certain men in general. You know, what's just the reality of being a female, just the little ways that being a female is, you know, and I like being, I'm not complaining about it. It's not, it's just, you know, this the whole thing blows up and I feel like the women were like, oh yeah, you know, oh, I've been there. Oh, I know what you're saying. Like, cause it's all, you know, almost so obvious, so much an ingrained part of life that would even a lot of older women in particular, like, you know, we didn't really even question things.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I think these discussions have always been had. They're being had much more openly and in a way that I think that once we know, we got to sort through it all. And and I hope, and I think in the end, it will all settle a much better place for everyone. But, you know, in the meantime, there's a whole new set of complications, you know, we're seeing it now with believe women. No, you know, that's easy when, you know, then when it's your candidate, how does that work for you? You know, it's all of these big, you know, I don't know.
What's the believe woman thing? I don't know that.
Oh,
one.
The Biden thing.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just all the ways that can be complicated. And, you know, I was raised by my dad. So I, you know, and I had, you know, it was a fairly, my dad is wonderful and I have a great relationship with him. But prior to that, it was kind of a difficult, you know, time. So I'd say probably, you know, of my close friends, I'd say probably most of them are, a good number of them are guys. And so I'm also sympathetic, you know, to, I don't want to lump all men into one group, or, you know, so I've always had the conversations, but now I'm thinking about ways to portray them, or I guess, as usual, I'm not really thinking about it directly, but images are popping in there that hopefully convey a subtle mood rather than, you know, a direct kind of, I'm trying to, you know, make sure that they are not too dead on. So.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it sounds fascinating because, and kind of the times, because, you know, like the whole idea of the male gaze has come up quite a few times on the podcast, and it's not, I'm not saying it's the female gaze because it's a different kind of thing, but it's like,
I actually said that exactly when I was describing it to Stephen and Elaine, actually to Stephen Bennett, when I had lunch with them a few months ago, and I was telling them what I was working on. And I was like, I'm kind of interested in, this is like flipping a bit where it's the female gaze on the male.
Yeah. Well, it's, yeah. I mean, the male gaze is generally kind of, it's not, you know, it's kind of to do with the sexualizing yes. women. And I haven't seen the pictures, but it doesn't sound like that's what you're going to be doing.
No, I haven't.
But
really,
it's a woman's perspective on men and what's gone on for men, which is kind of fascinating. But it sounds great.
And of course, you know, I could put them out there and people think they're ridiculous, but that's the chance you take. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That is the chance you take. But yeah, you're right. Like, I mean, we haven't a clue really what it's like. Men don't really have a clue what it's like to be a woman. And probably it's the same, but like, you know, women are not predatory towards men the way men are towards women.
Right.
So men don't have to deal with that. So this whole male privilege thing, you know, you really have to sit down with the woman and get her to explain it to you before you kind of go, oh, okay, really? Yeah, you're walking home and you're afraid. Oh, yeah, that just would never even occur to me.
The little ways that you absorb it, and it just becomes life. And I think my greatest hope with all of this is that, you know, I won't, that my girls won't have someday the same kind of like Me Too stories, or, you know, or they will have a much more muted version of that. That would be my hope.
Yeah.
We'll see.
I mean, when you were talking there, I was kind of thinking it really depends on the generation you're talking to, because if you my daughter's 27 and, like, you know, there's a whole other generation below her as well. But like, just listening to her talk and at her and her friends and even the young men friends, you know, there's a world of difference, you know, like I was just saying on the last chat I had, last podcast I did with Kwong and Adrian Stein. And I was saying basically, like, for somebody of my age, well, I find it very helpful to start off from the perspective of, yes, I was raised in a very sexist environment, so I'd have to just take it that I'm sexist without even realizing it, and start there, and then see where I can go from there.
Oh God, well, you're miles ahead of most of the people most of the men I talk to. That's great. That's usually, you have to do battle to get them even an acknowledgement that there is such a thing as any kind of privilege, or maybe not usually, but often. I think that's probably changing. But the younger, I am totally with you. You know, my girls, they take so much less shit. Like, it wouldn't even occur to them. And it's not, and their friends, the guys that they're friends with are a different entirely than I remember boys being way back when.
Yeah.
So I do think it is already, it's changing, it's seeping in, it's going to be better for them. Yeah. Despite what, you know, our immediate situation and who our role models are right now.
Yeah, well, again, that's a generational thing. Yeah. Because, you know, when you are raised in a sexist environment and you are raised to think you're the king of the world, that male privilege thing makes it very hard to self-reflect on it, because you can't, kind of go, you know what, this, you know, it's like somebody did, I was on, I think, 30 Rock, they did this thing about really attractive people, And Tina Fey was going out with John Hamm, right? And she was kind of going, everything is, everything's different if you're really attractive. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, it never even occurred to him. And it's kind of like that with men, I think. Like, it just,
I think so.
They really have to do a lot of work to kind it's of funny, start to see it.
I referenced that episode quite a bit with my boyfriend. He's, you know, a handsome guy. And he does tend to go through the world thinking that, waitresses are just nice and people will just hold a table for you and you'll always get in this. And I'm always like, they would never do that if it was just me. You know, it's your bubble. I reference The Bubble all the time.
Oh, okay.
And I forced him to watch that episode because I thought, and he just sort of shrugs it off. He's always like, oh, you know, because he just thinks everyone's nice and friendly. And
yeah,
I'm like, no. But I mean, that's kind of less of a male privilege than it is a pretty privilege. And
no, but the dynamic's the same. The dynamic is the same. It's, you know, it takes a lot. I find it anyway. And I, you know, it's just like, I find I have to, like, it's not just something that happens automatically. I have to actually be very conscious about it. Kind of go, no, my perspective is not, it's not necessarily the way things are for everybody. And certainly for women.
It's a hard thing though. It's a tall order though, to expect people to imagine a complete reality outside of their own. I get that. I understand it's not going to be. Yeah, but as long as we're moving in the right direction, I suppose.
Okay, we had some questions come in. This is from Kate Geiger in Philadelphia, and she says, do you use a sketchbook, and how important is sketching when coming up with ideas for paintings?
I rarely use a I guess I do have a couple of sketchbooks lying around, but they're not like the gorgeous Cesar Santos style sketchbooks that should be in a museum.
Anybody have sketchbooks like Cesar? Jesus.
Oh, I know. It's nauseating. Like you, ugh. I know. Wonderful, obviously, everything he does. But I think, for me, I tend to write down in my phone just long-winded, you know, descriptions of everything because usually they happen when I'm out and about. So I have dozens and dozens and dozens of those. But then sometimes when I get back, I'll do just a stick figure kind of rough idea of where things will go.
Yeah.
But I don't do anything more detailed than that because I just usually by that point I'm just too impatient to get on with it and get stuck into the painting. Right. So that's really the extent of it.
Okay. Jaden Mooney in Memphis asks, how do you come up with your compositions?
They're usually just, it all kind of comes somewhat fully formed, you know, just kind of drops in there. I rarely get an idea when I'm looking for an idea. It's only happened once that I can think of, and that was a recent painting when I actually was given, it was the only time this has ever happened where I was given a theme that I had to work to. And it worked out in the end, but it caused complete panic initially because normally they do just kind of a rough idea or sometimes a very detailed idea will just kind of come drop in my head when I'm out and about, usually walking or running or doing something else. Hmm. And then it's a case of, you know, just refining or trying to find the source, the reference material for it.
Yeah.
And assembling it. So I kind of back into it. I don't go out looking. I don't know how to do that. I wish I did. And I need to practice working that way more, I think, because it would be far more efficient if I had instead the thought, you know, here's what I've been thinking about. I've been thinking about, you know, the Me Too movement. How do I represent that? I'm going to go and then I'm going to go. That would be a much easier way to do it, I think. But I so far have never been able to make that work, really.
So it sounds like you see the finished painting in your head first, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like a sort of photographic memory in reverse.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I do. And I usually see the person, whoever it is that I know or I've seen around in it or some, you know, and I try as much as possible to keep that person in it if they'll agree. And usually pretty much. Then sometimes I run up against issues where that can't actually happen. So whereas whatever I've seen in my head, the logistics are too hard. So I have to adapt to it a little bit. But where possible, I just...
The logistics of getting the reference organized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
you know, there's sometimes also where it's in my head, but then when I actually get there, I'm like, oh, I never thought about, you know, something about assembling it just doesn't work. I realize that I've condensed too many things in my head that won't actually fit in an actual painting in the right way. So I play around with it then. But
And do you use Photoshop or anything like that with your reference, or how do you, or do you sketch it out, or?
I don't sketch it out. No. I, up until fairly recently, I would always print out like loads and loads of photos, sometimes dozens of pictures of each little component, and I have to have them spread out on the floor because I didn't know Photoshop. So I would be working from, you know, 20 photos, but I didn't know how to combine them into one finished thing. And I still don't know how to do anything advanced with Photoshop or anything beyond. I can do now a thing where you can cut a person out of one photo and put them in another, but I can't do it anything beyond that. So a lot of the time that's too much of a pain and it's not even necessary if it's just going to be something, you know, one or two people, something simple. But I do use it sometimes.
Yeah.
And, but a lot of the time it's, I'll have I'll work from photos with the person and then I can, but if there's objects, I might switch out an object and just bring it into the studio and work from it. Just stick it in the corner and work from it there.
Right.
You know, I won't bother photographing a thing in, you know, sort of resetting up an image again. I'm very loose with the reference, probably more than I should be, because I give myself a lot of trouble then when I'm actually executing the painting, that I think I could probably be faster if I learned Photoshop, you know, got a bit more skilled in that. But
I think everybody learns about as much as Photoshop as they need. I don't know if anyone knows the the whole thing, unless maybe graphic designers, but I don't know. Okay. Ryan C. McLedden in South Carolina asks or says, lighting is so crucial to creating mood and leading the narrative. How do you go about staging the lighting for these purposes within the references prior to rendering?
Lighting is important. I'm thinking now, I screw that one up quite a bit actually, and end up again giving myself a lot of extra work. The one I did several years ago was, I think we even talked about it the last time, was about the one with the sheep. And I posted recently some reference photos because people love and asked me about that. And in that, you'll see that there's one where I made clay horns that I held up, but I held them up. I wanted a certain light to come through. In the end, I couldn't get it quite right, but because I've learned how sometimes the things I think that will be the most complicated are not, and the things that I think will be simple. Usually it's a lighting issue. He's right about that. I just basically, the answer to that is I should be spending a lot more time on it than I do. And, I mean, a lot of it, when it's outside, it's fine. That's usually takes care of itself. Interior shots. And I don't ever take shots in my studio. Just because really I don't know enough about lighting to try and replicate anything believable inside. So, that's on my to-do list. Get better at lighting.
Okay. Bishan Singh in India says, your work is absolutely amazing. Your self-portraits are very interesting and I find them much more than just a self-documentation. I'd like to know, what's your thought process behind these brilliant self-portraits?
Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you, Bishan. Each one is kind of different. And there isn't, again, like I was saying before, there's not really a thought process ahead of time. You know, it's one will show up and then a lot of the time I figure out what it was about as I'm painting it or after I've painted it. If the general composition seems compelling as a painting and it's noisy enough, I'll be like, all right, I got to paint this. And sometimes I start.
Sorry, when you say noisy enough, you mean internally noisy?
In my head, yes.
Yeah,
persistent, I suppose. And sometimes, you know, a lot of the time it's very obvious. It's about, you know, I've been stressing about something or thinking about mulling something over. And then a visual manifestation of those deep thoughts will kind of accompany the thoughts, maybe.
Yeah.
And I just sort of draw that the way I see it and paint it the way I see it. Yeah. The only one, the self-portrait that I've done recently that wasn't, that didn't come about that way was the one I did. I have a newspaper clown collar on, and that one was a theme given to me by a curator in a Belgian curator who I've now been in a couple of group shows that she has been involved with. Okay. That were really great opportunities over there. And then, but those were existing paintings that I had that weren't done for those shows. But then she invited me to participate in this new one, which will hopefully be going up in October. It's obviously been put off for a while.
Yeah.
Over in Belgium. And the theme for that was all the artists participating had to do a self-portrait as a clown.
Right.
Because it's, the museum is in some medieval city and there's a circus kind of history to the place. And so that, I agreed. I said, absolutely, I'd love to be a part of it. And then proceeded to melt down for a day or two because I thought, well, what? I've never done this. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to work to a theme. It's, you know, but then I simmered down and just, again, I was thinking about it for a couple of days and that just kind of came into my head. But it obviously, because I didn't want to, I was trying to think of all kinds of, I wanted it to be something kind of current because it's not really about me. I wanted it to be, you know, outward looking kind of thing. And what was going on at the time, what I was thinking a lot about was the news. And so, and feeling a little bit, a little bit suffocated, I suppose, or choked by the news, I suppose, was the thing. And so I just thought of the collar, to be a clown collar. And then I went out and got the Times that day and just made it out of that day's New York Times and left a few headlines prominent to get my, you know, not to be too heavy-handed, but it was just, I didn't make anything up.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was that. So that was that one, very simple.
It's got a medieval kind of vibe to it, probably because of the color you could.
I wanted to have a nod to that kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but not be too obviously clownish with a big red nose or anything. I wanted it to be a little bit, you know, a little bit more subtle maybe.
Yeah.
And then some of them are just, yeah, I suppose the one I've done, another one, the one you have on the little icon for the, mm-hmm. so
for that, the Instagram, yeah.
That one's kind of about the struggle over the last couple of years to, it started off being about the idea of, it started off being about trust, I suppose, if I think about it correctly. It was about, you know, after so long being by myself, kind of settling down into being in a regular relationship again, I found that I was a bit skittish, you know, occasionally at first. And I had the sense of futility at one point of like, will I ever be able to just be normal and not overthink everything and catastrophize everything and come up with the worst case scenario for absolutely everything? And it was more about myself, my own. It was nothing to do with anything he was doing. It was just my own internal jumping around all over the place and always looking for the next, you know, thing to go wrong. And it just had this kind of exasperating one day, like, ugh, it just feels like being on this wheel of, you know, getting control of your own tendencies, you know, the grooves that you get into over and over again. And
yep.
So that wanted to convey a sense of futility. And then when I was, you know, that, of course, that feeling passed and things settled down completely. But I do think now when I look at it, I think more about the frustration of finishing a painting and the fact that I always get to that point where I feel like that. I feel like I'm almost getting somewhere. And then I go back out and I look at it and I'm like, oh, this is the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. And then you have no choice but to keep trying and keep, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a bit, I don't know. So they're all different. They all come from whatever's going on with me at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, brilliant. And with the candle and the matches and everything like that, you saw all of that at the same time.
Yes.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. And then that one, what's funny is like, then I had a bugger of a time trying to get the curtains done. I thought the curtains would be so easy, but of just curtains blowing in the end. I ended up just doing the best I could with it. But yeah, it's always, you know, it's always the thing in the background that should take up maybe 5% of your time. It takes up 80% of the time when you just want to, you know, stick a screwdriver through it. But anyway.
Mary Chiamonte in Virginia is a patron of the podcast. Thanks for the tea, Mary. She is similar. You may have covered this, but I'll ask it anyway. Will you tell us about your self-portrait with the Elizabethan newspaper collar?
Yeah.
I looked at that one for a good long time. Gorgeous work. Want to add anything?
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you, Mary. No, other than that, yeah, that will be going. I think it's going to be over there for a couple of years, that one over in, and that one working, there was a size constraint for that as well, which was interesting for me. So it's very small. It's only 12 by 16, which I've never worked that small. So, oh, and also with that one, it was a good discovery, which I am, a couple of the ones I'll be working on, I will have some newspaper in as well. How easy it is. That's one of those little great discoveries, because I thought, oh god, painting a newspaper, that's going to take me forever, but it's in my head, so I've got to do it. And turns out all you do is you write, as long as you write the letters of the headlines, then you can just do like basically smudge and blot with blue shop towels all of the rest of it, and it looks like you've written little words and thing, but you haven't. You've just, it's really, really easy to make newspaper look like it took longer than it did. So there you go.
All right. Because I was about to ask you, did you get the, you know, the jeweler's goggles on and the, because there's a small little painting, if by what you're saying.
Yeah.
Oh, yep. Okay. Very good.
So that was, yeah, that was nice.
Are you still, do you still have the same working method? Like when we were last talking, you were saying, I started the eye and then it all comes out from there. Is it still the same or has it changed?
Most of the time, right now I'm doing a painting of a friend. I started it a week ago, and that because I keep in between paintings, you know, that start that way and are more laborious, part of my trying to loosen up. I'm going to do this as often as I can, force myself to start with the way most people do, that I see people do online, with the bigger brushes and big, big things of color, and just not starting with the eye. And so I did that with, and I thought this is going to be great. So I, you know, and it was fun. It was really fun to do it that way. And I thought, I will be done with this thing in 3 days. That will be a record. This is amazing. And then, you know, I take my eye off the ball for a second. Like, next thing I know, 10 hours have gone by and I'm zoned in, and I haven't, and I'm in that, and I'm putting in the details. And the brushes are getting smaller, and everything's getting more accurate. And I'm like, damn it. Because then once you've done that in part of it, you got to do it in all of it. So I keep trying to just leave a thing loose, like, you know, but I'm my own worst enemy. It's like, if I don't have somebody poised waiting there to whisk it away before I do that, then as soon as I stop paying attention, I'm getting totally into the weeds with it. So it was fun. It was a good experiment. And partly how I'm doing that, how I'm forcing myself to loosen up, at least in the beginning, is by using random tubes of paint. Because a friend of mine had, you know, I don't know, a couple years ago, just given out a whole bunch of old art supplies. He was an art teacher. And I have dozens and dozens of tubes of paint that I've never used these colors. Because I've always had such a limited palette. So I'm trying to open up random tubes of paint and be like, okay, this is roughly a red, this is roughly a yellow, and your black will be your blue, and just try and do your best to make flesh color out of whatever. Right now I'm using a quidacrin something red, I think, which is a pinkish red, and a Venetian something, and then nickel yellow. And none of which I've used before, and so I'm not able to get the exact skin tones that I can usually. So that takes some of the, you know, the compulsive stuff out of it, because it makes it impossible for me to actually match the color exactly. So anyway, so that's what I hope to keep doing. I also have, with a couple of little panels I made that I made myself so I feel like I can waste them. I've been doing just with no reference at all, just, you know, when I have that snapshot in my head of something, just painting it the way I, exactly the way I see it in my head.
Yeah.
With no reference at all, which is, it's fun. I don't know if anyone will ever see them, but they've gone better than I thought they would. So
okay.
That's another good exercise just to try and force.
Yeah. I was going to ask you that. Do you do color studies at all before you start the main painting?
No.
No,
no.
Just get straight into it. Yeah. And are you still mostly painting on canvas, or have you gone into other substrates, you know, like aluminium or boards or?
Well, I have made all these boards. I got a big thing of MDF and looked up online how to prep them. And I've used a few of those, mainly for small things. And I enjoy working on it. It's nice. I haven't done anything, but I don't think you can really use them for larger work. So I'll work my way towards that. But I've never worked on any of the aluminium or any of those other things.
Yeah, right. Okay. So when we last spoke, you just started to really get into the Zorn palette. Have you expanded beyond that, other than what you were just saying about those experimental colors? Like,
no, but that is the idea with that, to give myself a red and a yellow, not this, you know, with the Zorn, it's the cadmium red and yellow ochre,
yeah,
but sort of try and, so it's the same idea really, I suppose.
Yeah.
But, and it's, you know, throughout, some of the colors just don't work at all. And then there's, you know, there's a couple that I'm kind of into. Like, I think that nickel yellow will have a permanent place, maybe. I think that one might be kind of nice to add permanently. But other than that, no, I haven't done much with the Zorn palette recently, because I think it's fun and I did a few, and I'll always go back to that, I suppose. But, you know, I feel like for this next big, I think when I'm doing a whole grouping in theme, they're all a similar theme, I either do them all in the Zorn palette or none of them.
Right.
You know, I'll stick to my regular palette for that.
But as your palette, do you have more colors? Like Zorn's about, what is it, five? Have you got more colors in it now than just the five, or is there more?
No, anytime I do a Zorn thing, it's the same four. It's yellow, four. Ochre, cadmium red, ivory black, and titanium white.
Have you gone beyond that now though?
My regular palette is not the Zorn palette. My regular palette is I still pretty much have that the same way. That's yellow ochre, cerulean blue, and alizarin crimson for flesh tone, and titanium white, ivory black, Van Dyke brown, and usually ultramarine blue.
Right.
And that's it.
That's it. Very good. What's that? That's under 10, is it, in total?
Yeah, it's not that. It makes it easier when you don't have to recreate. You know, you can get pretty much everything you need with that, and you don't. Oh, and also something I can never remember. It's one of the siennas. I don't know if it's raw or burnt.
Okay.
One of those sometimes on there.
Yeah, raw or burnt. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, God, I'm really enjoying this podcast. I've listened to a few now and they're brilliant. And there's so many of them. And I've learned so much from listening to them. And you know what? If I met that John Dalton fella in real life, I'd love to buy him a cup of tea and have a chat with him. I'd love to do that every month if I could. Well, now you can. The tea part, at least, because this podcast runs on cups of tea bought for me by people like you who listen to the podcast and send me the price of a cup of tea once a month through the Patreon account. That's patreon.com/John Dalton, gently does it, all one word. And if you're one of those people who already send me cups of tea through Patreon, thanks a million. The tea is lovely and I really appreciate it. Now, the great thing is that if you can't afford to send me the price of a cup of tea, or you don't want to, that's fine. You still get exactly the same podcast for free. It's sort of an honor system where the people who can afford it and want to pay for the people who can't or don't want to. So it's all lovely. So if you'd like to send me a cup of tea once a month, you can do that through Patreon. I'd really appreciate it. It makes a huge difference to me. Mitch Griffiths in the UK, a former podcast guest, and he says, brilliant artist. He's talking about you.
Well, that's very nice to hear from Mitch Griffiths.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Unbelievable.
And he asks, do you use any mediums with the paint?
I use a little Gamsol usually for the first pass at it. And then after that, once that's completely dry, I'll use about a third stand oil, two-thirds Gamsol.
Okay.
For all the subsequent. That's it. I've never really tried anything else. Sometimes, actually, no, if I have to go really fast, I'll use the Liquin just to speed up the drying. Yeah.
All right.
In areas.
Do you have a preferred type of brush or make of brush that you like?
Cheap.
Cheap. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm going to trash them anyway. That's the reality. I have, there's a craft store around near me called AC Moore, and they have these brushes that are $1.99. And so, and they're pretty, you know, and they're good. They last all right amount of time. You know, I'm just really tough on the brushes. I tend to leave them way too long overnight in the freezer for way too many nights.
Right.
And before finally cleaning them, and then they're all fried. So then I go back in and with a pair of scissors, usually after I've washed my brushes, which is every, let's say every few days, I wish maybe every week. when I finally take them out of the freezer, work with them, and they're like, okay, they're getting properly cleaned today. And then when they're dry, I just get the scissors and I cut the stray bits off.
Yeah.
And so they get smaller and smaller and smaller. But that's good. You can use them for a long time that way. You know, get a really fine point on some of them. So, yeah, I don't know what the brand is, but I was given somebody very nicely when I did a thing for a magazine. They sent me some brushes, some really nice sable brushes, and I felt so bad when I destroyed them.
Yeah. So, is it mostly rounds you like?
Yeah. I like. Yeah, I use a lot of when the smaller ones are round,
yeah.
And then the flat squared off ones.
Yeah.
And then filberts filberts that are about this big.
Yeah, that's about half an inch. Yeah.
Yeah, and that will be for most of the face. Will be that, and then with the, yeah, and that's I don't use the large round brushes,
okay.
And I'm always on the hunt for one of the really soft brushes, you know, the big fluffy mop brushes that doesn't shed, which I had one for years and then it fell apart. By the end, there was nothing left of it. But I've never found one again that doesn't shed, even the higher end ones that I've tried.
Right.
Because the way I use them, you can't have one single thing come off. Because I'll do it when, for instance, if I'm trying to make a sky look really smooth and blend subtle color from one to the other, and you know, I slap up all of the paint, and then I'll get one of those, and just because sometimes you just don't want any lines,
yeah,
at all, or I don't. Sometimes in the real background, I want it to be completely smooth, and everything will go on top of that. And for those, I used to use that brush that I miss a lot to just knock down. To take away all the brushes. So you barely touch it to it and it can look completely smooth.
Flat, yeah.
But if you put one brush, one hair comes off on that, and then you have to dig that out and you fingernail all the way through the paint, then you got to start. Yeah. It's really annoying. So
yeah. Bolt of lightning, maybe. I find fan brushes are great for that. Big ones.
I've tried, maybe I don't have the right one. That's what somebody else had said to me a while back, because you don't get the edge then, the two edges of it. But I've... maybe I need to find a softer one of those. The ones I've tried so far have left the actual individual.
Well, I don't know. For me, anyway, I just use it like a fan, actually. Like I go really fast with it.
And really?
Yeah, and it almost buffs the paintbrush strokes off the paint rather than, I don't go slow. I'm like, I almost start away from it and then kind of go in. You know, I start moving it like a fan and then go in on it. And yeah, that smooths out everything. And when I started doing it first, I thought, okay, this is going to be a catastrophe because I'm going to just drag all the paint because it's wet. But it doesn't. I don't know how it does it, but it doesn't.
Oh, wow.
And they're not expensive. The ones I use are similar.
Oh, I'm going to try
that. Cheap. Yeah, yeah.
That's a thing that I always have. Yeah, let's see the...
Yeah, about that size.
OK, Okay.
That's grand. Yeah.
All right. That's
synthetic, I think. Yeah. Cheap.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I'm holding up my fan. What is it? Does that have a number on it? Number 9 fan brush. Okay. Oh, yeah. How do you check yourself when you're working? You know, like, do you use mirrors or take photographs or you're back and forth all the time or what do you do?
I don't do it enough. I should be, I think the, I try to get Zoom back as much as I can. And recently I found that taking an iPhone picture at the end of the day can be pretty brutal, actually, because it'll show you somehow. It must be the way my lighting is in the studio, maybe, but like I used to, the way that my easel was angled, I used to, you know, sometimes get some pretty good iPhone shots, but now it just shows every flaw, which is good when you're in the process of, you know, trying to, you know,
yeah,
because you can work all day and think that it looks great. And then either zooming, sit, you know, scooting back in my chair, and then I'll be like, ugh, you know, see all the problems.
And do you mess around with it on your iPhone? Like, do you make it black and white and fiddle with the contrast just to sort of show yourself different things?
No, it's usually very glaringly obvious where I've gone wrong. Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking of last night or the night before last where I was like so pleased with myself up close with what I had done. And then I was like, oh, shit, that's all right. Not done yet.
Yeah.
So, but, and when you're talking about the contrast there, I don't know whether it was something I was listening to you talk to someone about or where, but the glasses, do you know people that use glasses to see? Now, what glasses do they use? Because that's what I was Googling, trying to find the other day.
Well, okay, there's two things. There's those, well, David Eichenberg, who does hyper-realistic stuff, he uses he uses jeweler's glasses. So they're big goggly things that, that you know, that you sort of, they sit on your head and you fold them in.
Oh, to see more detail, you mean? No, I don't want to see more detail.
Yeah.
I want to see the ones that are the value-correcting kind of deal where you, it basically it's the same as squinting apparently.
Oh yeah, I don't know what other people use, but what I use is, you know, in the like in the chemist or whatever, they'll have those reading glasses. They're generic reading glass, and it's like +1, +2, +3, +whatever.
Yeah
I get a like +3 and I'll sort of balance those on the end of my nose, and then I'll just sort of look through them, and it saves me having to squint. And it also means I can see.
That's a really good
idea. I can look over. I can look over them at my reference, which will be focused, if you know what I mean, because I'm not looking through the glasses.
That's such a good idea.
So I'm looking over at my reference, and then I'm kind of, you know, I'll just kind of notch my head back a little bit, and I'll be look. I'll almost paint with them. I'll paint through them. Depends on what I'm doing, but that's what I do anyway.
Now, does that mess with your eyes? See, of course, the hypochondriac in me is immediately thinking, well, will that permanently ruin my eyesight?
No, that's actually...
doesn't
like,
work that way?
Well, gone off on a tangent here, but there's a method of natural vision improvement, right, called the Bates method, which I think was invented... No, it's an American. I was going to say I think he was a Scottish guy. But either way, there's an optician back in the 50s called Dr. Bates. And he was... his approach was that... normally with say with opticians, they'll say that what causes the lens in your eye to focus are they're called the ciliary muscles around your lens, so that your lens is a little bit like a balloon filled with water, let's say, and the muscles, there's a ring of muscles around it, and it stretches it into a pancake or it relaxes it back into a balloon, and that's how you focus. That's the kind of normal way of thinking about it. His idea was that the extrinsic muscles of your eye, which are the muscles that move your eyeball around, that they are also involved in focus. And that, so he developed these set of exercises for your eyes. It's called the Bates method, where you exercise those extrinsic muscles, and that you can, you know, if you're starting to lose, get long-sighted or short-sighted, by doing these exercises, you can overcome it because you're not just relying on the ciliary muscles. Because the thing is, when you put glasses on, it actually makes the extrinsic muscles atrophy because you have to keep looking through the glasses all the time. So you're not looking around as much with your eyeballs. One of the exercises in the Bates thing is you have two pencils and you have one that's very close to your eyes and the other one mm-hmm. you hold far away, and you kind of go back and forth between the two. So long-winded, getting back to your original question. Doing that, forcing your eyes to focus back and forth is actually not, it wouldn't damage them. If anything, it might help.
Actually help. Okay, yeah. Great. Yeah. I'm going to try that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're listening, one thing you can do is if you're in front of a screen a lot is have something behind your screen that's a very far away that you can look at. That'll exercise it. Yeah. Yeah. There's stories about when Native American Indians came into the classroom first, they couldn't focus on the blackboard. They're so used to looking into the distance. Yeah. And then after a while they could, but then they couldn't see in the distance anymore. Like their long vision was, I don't know whether this is true or not, but it's a nice story. Their long vision was fantastic.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, they could see things in the distance really clearly. But then after a bit of time in school, you know, a couple of months, their long vision actually started to deteriorate.
Wow.
There you go.
There you go.
So yeah, that's good. What I do. Get 2.5, or I think it's 2.5s or 3s. Hang on, there's here. I can look. And yeah, that's what I do. I use them. That doesn't say them. I think they're 2.5s.
That must have been you then. I heard reference it probably ages ago because I don't remember to squint enough.
Oh, 3s. They're 3s. Maybe, no, 3.5s. There you go. All right, but yeah, they're great. Really good.
All right.
Yeah.
That'll do the trick.
What sort of lighting setup do you actually have in your studio?
I have fluorescence. I block out all the light because I'm in there most of the time. I would say the longest stretches of time I get are still at night.
Right.
And so I never even bothered to, you know, the daylight thing is just, you know, until I am able to completely revamp the schedule and be in there, you know, more reliably.
When you say the daylight thing, you're not talking about daylight bulbs, are you?
No, I'm talking about actually working with natural
for real
light
daylight. Yeah,
that
okay.
stuff. Yeah. I don't. That would be if I worked with that, then it would just be. You know, I'd rather keep it. So I'm always in, you know, blackout curtains, and
yeah.
I have daylight bulbs. I don't know what kind they are. I used to have the Chroma 50s years ago. But I don't think they make the fixture anymore, but I have just overhead. It's not great, actually. I need to figure out another setup at some point because there's too much glare right now, I'm finding. So.
Okay. Kate Grieger in Philadelphia again asks, do you have any advice on getting past creative blocks?
Well, it used to be all about getting out for, you know, run for 10 miles, 20 miles, but my back is not, you know, not enjoying that these days. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. Don't quite know what's going on with it. It's been a few years. It's been progressively annoying. Nothing terrible. So it's just a compressed disc, but I don't want it to get any worse. So I'm not doing super long distances anymore. Yeah. But I think getting out into the middle of nowhere, but be moving. I think that's, you know, being engaged in something else, but just some physical activity is good to just, I think, you know, in the short term. I always found that if I started a run and at the beginning of it, if I knew I was going for 15, 20 miles and at the beginning I would consciously be thinking about whatever the problem was with a particular painting or an element that I felt was missing that I need to, you know, by the end of it, I'd always, you know, as soon as I zoned out, my brain switched off and I was just in a, you know, kind of automatic mode, then the solution would somehow magically appear.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, and in terms of the bigger block, the kind of big crisis of what do I paint?
Yeah.
I think for that, I could have ended that, I think, a lot sooner if I had just got out of my own way. I think that instead of taking a step back and thinking, you know, thinking it through properly, I just kept thinking, God, I haven't sent anything to the gallery in a while. You know, I was going to go to college. I've got to get some money aside. I've got to, you know, well, I know kind of roughly the type of thing that is expected. And so I'll just try and do a version of that. And I would you know, like I said before, I kept going down these paths that I didn't, that would peter out, and I would give up, and then I'd be like, because I what I didn't want to do is put stuff I hated out there. And so I think for in that case, it was kind of extreme. It took me completely, you know, disengaging from it entirely, and thinking, oh, well, you know, I can always go get a waitressing job, or I don't know, just sort of thinking, you know, having to game out the worst case scenario, if not worst case to be a waitress, not that, but just like if I have to be prepared to never paint again in order to fully close that door of the stuff that wasn't working before the stuff that I was meant to be doing kind of made itself known. Because until I did that, there was no room for anything new to come in, because I was too locked on to the old pattern that wasn't really doing it for me at that point. So I think, I don't know, it's a hard thing. It's I think it's paid. Everyone gets it from time to time. And I don't know. For me, again, it was always the physical activity distracting from it, but that doesn't work for everyone. Everyone's in a position to do that, and it's hard. It's hard when you
not everyone can run ultra marathons, even if they don't have a block.
Not everyone. Yeah, everyone's stupid enough to do that.
What you were saying though about, you know, getting out of your own way, like that all sounds really hard. Like what you've described, I can't. Like from what you said, I can't see how you could have done that in any other way. Like I mean, hindsight, maybe. You can look back and go, sure, that's all I had to do. But I don't think, from what you've said anyway, you could have speeded that up.
Maybe not. I think also, you know, life stuff was happening. You know, I was going from one kind of life to quite a different one. And I think part of it was also, you know, not being in that state of, you know, at least in terms of my life, not in terms of work, but in terms of my day-to-day life, not being in so much sort of stress there, you know, like, this is kind of normal. Like I'm having a normal thing. I'm not feeling so isolated anymore. Yeah. I'm actually, you know, happier.
Yes.
And so I don't only want to be able to produce work when I'm unhappy. And then I got so terrified that that was the case that I made it happen. So now I'm realizing, you know, I'm sure the next block will be about something else. You know, it's funny because I did do a transitional painting that, again, in this case, it was that I really didn't like how I had, it was a technical thing. Like I just didn't like how I'd composed it, but God didn't stop me spending like 3 months on the damn thing that is now gathering dust. But it was thinking about that as I was sort of moving into this other kind of stage. I was reminded of a Damien Rice song that I think is about that. And do you know, you must know Damien Rice, right?
I know. He's always around here. Yeah.
But he's the Irish guy.
I don't know him personally, but yeah, I know of him. Yeah. I know his music. Well,
he wrote the song that, and I remember listening to him give a preamble in some concert about how that's kind of where he was. He hadn't recorded anything in a while. People were always asking him when he was, and he's kind of saying that he's like, you know, I kind of write about stuff when I'm miserable, and I'm not really miserable.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to always be miserable in order to write. And I think, you know, and I haven't seen him do anything new in a very long time. So maybe he just went off and was happy and didn't do anything again. But but I was thinking about that, got me thinking about that kind of, he said, you know, something about, it's called The Gift or something, I think was the name of it. But about the double-edged sword of that, you know, what was expected of him was this thing that he no longer felt.
Yeah, Alice. Yeah, Alison Moyet always comes to mind. Do you remember her?
Oh, yeah, God.
Yeah,
that's a blast.
Yeah, it is in Blast from the Past. But I remember, probably because it made an impression on me when I read it, an interview with her, and she was married, happily married, and she purposely broke up her marriage because she said, I couldn't write anything. I was too happy. I just couldn't, nothing was coming. So, I, you know, it meant more to her to be able to make songs and all that kind of thing. I don't know.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how I remember it. Sorry, you know, Allison, if you're listening and it's not true.
No, I can see that being not that would be a thing I would do, but it's a little, when you do work that's very, very personal, your personal life, you know, I realized at a certain point, God, my personal life really matters, you know, in terms of what I'm producing.
Yeah, you know, it's informative. Yeah.
So I needed a bit of a reckoning there, and I needed to be forced into a spot where, you know, I had to, I guess what I found out was that I can still find things to paint about that aren't directly about me. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And but that's going to take some practice, you know, that's a new way of working. So I'm going to, you know, going to have to, and then also hopefully the next time there is a change in my life of some kind or another, which was, you know, it's always going to be evolving. Hopefully I don't have to be floundering again.
Yeah.
In that way.
Yeah. Well, it sort of keeps coming to mind as you're talking, is that thing of like, it really doesn't matter what you paint. Everything's a self-portrait.
Well, yeah, I think in my case, for sure, that is, because I think about that a lot, and I think about how much easier it would be if I, because I remember you talking to, I think it was Vincent Desiderio. I know you've done another one with him, but I haven't heard that new one, but about the technical narrative and the,
yes,
you know, it's the story narrative, I guess, or the other, and best if you can have some of both, but when you have the technical, I guess that's what's missing entirely from my work and my way of working, is the technical narrative, because I haven't, maybe that's a focus I need to have more going forward, is, you know, less about the content and more about the paint. You know, how you put the paint on. I don't know.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because just having a quick look at your work before our chat, I was kind of going, yeah, it's changed. Your painting has changed. And it's changed the change, as far as I see it, is in the technical narrative. It just, I don't know, how would I describe it? There's a kind of a lushness there that wasn't there before. That's not to say that your previous work wasn't lush.
No.
It was, but there's a sort of a lush, glowing quality. And it's a sort of a richness and texture. And to me, anyway, it does look like it's part of the technical narrative, because the dramatic narrative is still, you know, it's very much personal story and all we've been talking about it. But yeah, it looks like it has, I see a change anyway.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to hear, because I think I haven't consciously put effort into that. But I think that when there are big changes, you know, if you can know that, like, for instance, the people who can paint anything and it's definitively theirs, and it's beautiful to look at. And as the viewer, you're not so focused on the content or the story in there.
Yeah.
You know, like Dan Sprick the other day sent me some little things he's working on at home, and there, you know, it's like a corner of his room. It's like out the edge of a window and a corner of the room, and it's stunning and it looks so compelling and it's got such a mood. And I'm like, oh God, like to be able to just to be stuck and to know that I can paint a damn light switch or a, you know, and make it look like something that should be a painting. I don't know. I'm jealous of that for sure. But, and then I've been also looking a lot at this woman, and maybe it was you that posted it actually, Anne McGill.
Oh my God. She's fantastic.
I mean, I have been really, I think, yeah, another one that makes me jealous, because I've been looking at her work.
She must wear the glasses all the time when she's painting.
But that's what I'm saying. Like the mood, she's just such a mood with so just very subtle. And, you know, that is such a distinctive style that she has. And it gets across everything that you would want to get across. Everything that takes me months and painstaking detail and tearing my hair out. I mean, I'm sure she has her own. I'm sure that it's not. I envision her working just in a blissful state of, you know, slapping up the paint and effortlessly and everything being great, but maybe it's not quite like that. But certainly when I'm getting myself all bogged down in the details.
Well, I don't know if this is of any help to you, but how I resolve that inside myself, because I was the same, you know what I mean? The way I paint is a certain way, mm-hmm. but I like a lot of paintings. I like a lot of different types of people. And of course,
yeah.
the people who I have this idealized idea that, you know, it's really easy for them.
Right.
And when it's not for me. Which is probably not true, as you say. But what I, inside anyway, I separated it out, my I, from what I actually do. Meaning, like, if I can appreciate a painting, that's to do with my I and my taste, you could say, in painting. And that actually informs the way I paint, even though it doesn't make me paint like that. So I kind of separated the two out, because it is easy to kind of squash the two of them together or overlap them and go, well, right. if I like that type of painting, why can't I do it? But I think it started with, I don't know if you know that Ira Glass, there's a famous kind of Ira Glass quote where he's talking about, he's the NPR.
Oh yeah, This American Life.
That guy, yeah.
Yeah.
His thing about taste, and he was saying your taste comes first, and to not be put off by the gap between your taste and what you can do, because initially there's going to be a gap and everything you do is going to look terrible to you. But the fact that you have an eye and that you have taste is going to make you...
Eventually we'll seep in, maybe.
Well, no, the fact that you think it's terrible, that's your taste. That's
right.
That's actually a quality. you might think it's a judgment, but, you know, it's a quality. And in time, the gap between your taste and what you actually produce, they'll come together. And what you'll be able to, when you produce something, you'll go, I'm happy with that. Right.
Right.
And so that kind of started me thinking about it, because, you know, as you say, there's so many different types of artists that it's very easy to kind of go, oh, why can't I paint like that? And why can't I paint like this and whatever? But for me, anyway, what helped me was to kind of separate it and go, that's my taste or my eye. And that's a great thing. And it's a, you know, it's a quality that I value. And then somewhere that activates the machinery inside me that helps me paint the way I paint. And they're separate
in some way.
Yeah, yeah. They're separate, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess that is always a, you know, and that's one of the, it's a good thing in some ways, but the downside of the social media thing, which I'm really not spending much time on anymore, but certainly not Facebook at all, but Instagram is, you know, there's some great work and I love seeing it, but then it can be a bit overwhelming, you know, all of the brilliant work, and I'm like, ugh. Yeah. I suppose everyone's in that boat, but
yeah, well, I suppose it's our version of, like, meaning the artist's version of, you know, looking at people who look like they have a fantastic life on Instagram,
yeah,
and going, God, they look like they really have it together. What am I doing?
Yeah.
What's wrong with me? You know, and I think it's the same. It's just an artist's version of that, because, you know, you can, like, you might have a particular facility to do a brilliant time lapse, you know, slapping the paint on, like you were saying. And I find those things mesmerizing, you know, but I have to keep coming back to, that's lovely. I really appreciate it, but it's not the way I work.
Right. I suppose that's it. You can't be everything. You got to just, you know, try and be comfortable in your own lane, not try and be in all the lanes.
That's it, yeah. This is a question from Molly Carberry in Ireland. She says, what are your top three tips for being a painter? And then she has in brackets, in general.
Ooh. I would say being very, very brutal with yourself, I suppose, initially, at least. Not seeking only feedback from the people that you know are going to say, oh, that's great. You know, because that's ultimately what we all want to hear every time anyone looks at anything we've done. But if you're showing someone something and you know deep down that you don't really, like, get used to listening to that voice you know, I mean, if you're lucky enough to find someone whose work you really respect and who knows what they're talking about and who is blunt without being cruel, keep that person around and go to them and take their advice if you really trust their aesthetic. And, you know, not blaming, I guess this is another rule, but related, resisting the urge to be bitter if you're rejected from things. You know, if you don't get into a certain thing, don't be like, oh, it's because I'm a woman or because I do this or because that's, even if that's true, it doesn't matter. Just always say, that's because I wasn't good enough. It wasn't good enough and I'll get better. And, you know, just digging in and because you're not going to, you know, I think, you know, I've heard it before from people, you know, that kind of thing. Oh, I can't get this gallery or I can't get whatever it is. So that contest only accepts this type of person or this type of work. And it's an awful lot of that. And I think that's just good. It's time wasting. It's not going to get you moved ahead at all. And so in the beginning, at least, you know, I think just, it sounds mean, but like being really brutally honest with yourself and looking at a thing and being, if it isn't good enough, fix it. Don't just, you know, keep putting stuff out there so that the people around you will, that, you know, are always, they're going to compliment you. They're going to say, oh, isn't that, that's amazing. And that's good. And they mean it. But you got to go to people that really know what they're talking about and take, you know, and get the less, you know, enthusiastic feedback, you know, and then you'll get better. It's not nice to hear somebody go, oh God, you know, that's totally out of proportion and that, but when you hear that and you act on it, then you can actually get something out of the feedback. Cause otherwise, you know, you don't want to get too complacent that you've mastered it.
Yep. Delusions of competency.
That sounds very mean.
Yeah. No.
Well, I suppose, because I do think that in a certain way, social media can really exasperate, like they can really compound that issue, you know, yeah. if that's your, if that's what you're, and which I like, I don't want social media to turn into blunt kind of, oh, that's a piece of garbage or that. I'm glad that that's not generally the way it is when you put work out there. I'm not saying I think, I just think in private, find yourself a really good mentor and, you know, listen to them.
Yep. When you were saying there about entering competitions and getting rejected, I was the juror for the Angies last year. And I only had one person get in touch and ask me why I didn't accept their work out of 400 plus people. I'd encourage you, if you're concerned.
That's a good point, yes.
Yeah, if you're concerned, the jurors may not get back to you, but they definitely won't get back to you if you don't get in touch. If you're wondering why you didn't get accepted, get in touch, ask them. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've
never done that actually, but I do think that's good advice. I think that's, as long as you're doing it in a way of like a respectful kind of, not, you know, in an accusatory, you know,
what's wrong with you?
Yes, like, you appreciate my brilliance kind of way. If it's done in a, listen, I really want to improve. I want to, you know, that's very smart. To do if that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, it made me slightly uncomfortable because nobody likes to give bad news, but I did.
Right.
I told them exactly why I didn't, you know.
Good for you.
I thought, good on that person for getting in touch, because absolutely. Now they know it's out of the mystery. Their demons haven't got hold of it.
Yeah. And they've totally, you know, now that's worth the entry fee for sure. Like that's worth entering anything to get that kind of honest feedback is hugely important. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other tips for being a painter? I don't know if you gave three. No, yeah, that was only really one, wasn't it? Or two. Well,
I think that was two.
Yeah. Okay.
other than, I think also, just appreciating the amount of isolation, you know, trying to find ways to grapple with that, because that can get you in the end, you know, being too much on your own. I think for people that have a community of other artists, I think that could be really important. I don't have as much of that as I would like to. I need to I need to do more about, you know, with that. But I think I used to go into the city a lot more often to openings and stuff. And then Arcadia closed and I stopped going in and I stopped sort of being around acquaintances and friends in the art world as much. Right. But even that kind of, I remember after any one of those, I just felt so much better. For weeks afterwards, I would be just, and even if we weren't talking about the work specifically, it was just the camaraderie of these people are getting out of their little isolated rooms and yeah, there's just kind of baseline. You all understand the,
they know the struggle.
The life. Yeah, exactly. That can help with it. Cause it can be, you know, cause you know, artists tend to be fairly, I don't know, internal, cerebral, sometimes maybe emotional types in touch with that. So, you know, you gotta keep control of that as well. With all of that isolation, that can be, you know,
yeah,
get the best of you.
Right. If there was one underlying theme to all your work, what do you think it would be?
Oh God, that's a hard one. I think for the first part, it would be isolation, I would say, in some form. And God, that's a really hard question. Now I don't know. I don't know if I'd have to really think about that one. God, I think these days, I mean, the thing I'm working on right now, I'm immediately going to that. There's one of a friend, but then I'm also working on one of Anya that is going to be highly inappropriate, I'm sure, when I put it out there. And then that one came more out of a joke I made, because my girls started off doing, they wanted to learn how to paint. Of course, they were all gung-ho and they were in for like 5 evenings. They came out and then they just, I don't know what, they went off to do other things. And they've got half-finished paintings sitting out in my studio, but I taught them how to staple the thing and they were arguing over, I can't remember what it was, but they were bickering while they were stapling the stretcher bars together. And I told one of them I was going to staple their mouth shut. I told Anya I was going to staple their mouth shut. I was just joking. Obviously, I've never laid a finger on them, but I do like to threaten to regularly. So, you know, and then they fell about laughing. They never take me seriously. But then I started thinking, huh, you know, I guess this is a more of a technical narrative thing, where I was like, I wonder if I could ever make that work, like without actually stapling her mouth shut. I wonder if I could recreate that. And I kept thinking about it for a couple of days. And then I thought, no, that will look abusive and everyone's going to hate me and think I, you know, it's just a little dark to have your, and I'm like, but it is pretty much a quarantine story, a teenager with her mouth stapled shut. And then I thought, well, if she's holding the stapler, then, you know, then it's fair game. She did it to herself. And so I'm almost done with Anya with her mouth stapled shut. So there is no theme there other than that was just me thinking, what the hell? And it's weird. I did actually manage to make it look as if she actually did staple her mouth shut. So we'll see what people think of it. They'll probably, you know, be horrified. But generally these days with the bigger group of paintings that I'm doing, like we talked about that theme.
Yeah.
But I think it'll probably always evolve.
All right. Carla Frank asks, or says, I saw in your feed that there was a time you didn't contemplate being a painter. The mind boggles. So how did it all come about then? Love your work.
Oh, thank you, Carla. No, definitely wasn't the plan. And just came about, you know, I don't know if we talked about this last time, just came about when I had my kids and moved out of the city and, you know, had been working in film and TV, long hours, not really a job I could go back to after having kids and living an hour away. So I was focused on being, you know, just being a mum for a year or two, and then realized that I was going to have to do something else too, to just keep my mind occupied, and thought, you know, oh, I used to draw when I was a kid, maybe I'll, and I, you know, I did go to art college, but I did silversmithing. I made little things out of metal. So I hadn't really done any drawing. And so, you know, here and there once or twice I would draw, and just started doing it when the kids were sleeping, just to occupy myself. And it just went from there. And for years, it was something I did at home. I, you know, had a corner of the room and painted and never got to go out and formally take classes and train properly and learn all the right names for things. Still don't know the right names for half of the things. And I just figured out the basics. And, you know, really, it's been within the last 8 years probably that it's become a full-time thing. Up until then, it was a thing I did, worked around the kids and the activities. And it's still, you know, as of 8 years ago, it's still something I do, you know, around the parenting, which really is the first, probably it always has to be the priority, which means I don't really know yet what it's going to look like when I don't have any interruptions and I don't have anywhere else, you know, my, you know, being pulled in all these different directions.
Yeah. Yeah.
That will be when I'll really see what that's like. I don't know. You know, it's, you know, the no excuses then, because right now it's like, I can always say, well, I do have two kids that I have to basically deal with, you know, and take to everything and their activities, and we don't live and they don't drive. So I've got to drive them places. And I never get that stretch, those stretches of uninterrupted time that you really are crucial. Yeah. And so getting sustained trajectory going in the studio is really, really hard. And so when they're gone, you know, I used to complain all the time as well that the dog, I have this big dog that needs so much looking after. And now the dog is not doing too well. I don't know how much longer he has. And I'm feeling really guilty that I complained all the time about having to look after him, because, you know, that'll be the first thing. There'll be no more walks that I have to keep interrupting to do. Anyway.
Yeah. You're not thinking of getting another dog?
No. I don't think so. I want to see what it's like to not look after anything for a while.
Okay.
You know, no, see, I'm saying that, and he's upstairs feeling terrible. Yeah, no, sorry, Seamus. I'm not wishing him away.
I think I heard a whimper there, but okay.
Terrible. It is so terrible, because I'm kind of joking about it, but like, I'm dreading it, because it is imminent. He's not even supposed to be here now. I had him at the vet a month ago. I took him in and they were like, you should probably have him. I had to go to the ER vet an hour and a half away, and they said that he wasn't going to, they didn't want to let him go, and they actually just put him down, and I took him instead. He's on all these medications and he's being spoiled rotten, and he's doing great, but it's only, you know, it's not curable. It's like a heart failure, so he's not got long. But then, no, I do think, you know, he's had a good run. He's lived a long, you know, a long life, and he's, you know, but I think, maybe eventually, but for a while, I'm curious to know, maybe I'll hate it if I can actually go in the studio and then be there without having to come out for 10 hours, you know, just allow myself to actually go off into that headspace, which really I only get at night. And then, of course, I'll be done at 3 in the morning, and then the next day is shot. And but, you know, being able to have a functional life and not be interrupted with a million things, we'll see. I don't know. I want to see what it's like. Maybe then I'll be driven nuts and I'll have to go out and get another dog. I don't know. Get another couple of kids. Kidding.
Yeah. Well, it is a challenge. I mean, everything has its own challenges. But yeah, I mean, it's what writers call the tyranny of the blank page. Like, when you have no constraints, no deadlines, no nothing, that's a whole new thing to deal with.
Yep.
Do you have any big art dreams you'd like to achieve before you die?
No big dreams at all, other than to keep doing it in a way that pays the bills, until I keel over. Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. No ambition beyond that. Cause I definitely don't have big dreams of great monetary, you know, success or anything. Cause I don't have a high overhead. You know, I don't like particularly fancy things that require a lot of money. I like it that way. But I would like to be able to sustain, you know, my life through what I do for the duration. I think that is probably more easily achieved if you don't have a big splashy moment where you're everywhere and then you're yesterday's news, maybe. So I'm leery sometimes of the you know, you have the big, you know, you're suddenly the people that I see at, you know, who are, that's got to be a lot of pressure if you're suddenly everywhere and, you know, celebrated a lot. I think that must be, I don't know. Of course, there I go with my negative thinking about everything, but like, I think that would, I just want to be able to quietly get on with painting the things I like to paint and hopefully have people buy them. Enough, not by all of them, but by enough of them that I can continue to
keep going. You know. Yeah. Yeah. Lovely. Okay. Last question. I'm asking everyone this question during lockdown, this pandemic quarantine time. It's sort of like, what would you like the world to look like when it comes out of quarantine? Not what you think is going to happen, but what you'd like to happen. What would you like to have changed?
I would like to see all caregivers and nurses suddenly make five times as much money as they make.
Oh, good now. One, yeah.
I've said this for a long time. I'll go off and rant if I, it's a very favorite rant of mine actually about how we deify the wrong people in our culture. And, you know, I don't give a rat's ass what some, you know, random baseball player thinks of the state of the world. I want to know what the Ebola nurses think of things, you know, the people that, you know, and I've been saying that for a long time. Now it's the COVID nurses, I suppose, but for ages that was my, it was always the Ebola nurses I was talking about, the people that, that do the really difficult work and rarely are appreciated. And I think we're really seeing that now. It's obvious to everyone, the people who are keeping the society moving along. And I would just love to see those people appreciated more. I'd like to see that continue on because they are appreciated more now. We're finally seeing them. Yeah. And now, and I think I want us to keep seeing them. And I don't know how that's achieved when they are no longer on the front lines. But I think, I like to think that that will, that we won't unsee that and that we will realize, you know, the people who look after our parents and grandparents and, you know, do these jobs usually thanklessly and with very little pay. So, yeah, that's what I would, that's the primary thing I would like to see continue that we already have right now. So it's the upside to where we are in this moment.
Great. Anything else? That was very good.
That's it.
All right. Okay. Well, lovely chatting with you as always. You if you're listening and you want to follow up on Katie, I'll just give you her Instagram. It's Katie O'Hagan Art. Easy enough to find. And then you can find her website and all that sort of stuff after. It's Katie, K-I-T-I-E, O'Hagan, yes. Not with a Y.
Right.
So, yeah, brilliant. Well done.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for answering everyone's questions.
Of course.
Yeah, lovely chatting with
you
again.
It was really nice chatting to you again. Yeah, we'll do another few years, hopefully in better circumstances.
yeah. And if you're over in Ireland and you're down the other end, give us a shout.
Absolutely.
Have a cup of tea.
We'll be back.
Yeah, yeah. Pardon?
Definitely. I said, we'll definitely be back.
Okay, right. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll keep in touch. But yeah, until we talk again, we'll say goodbye.
Bye.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.
Yeah. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps.